This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 3rd of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 60th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. What on earth is today's show about? What's the theme? What's the scheme? What's the apple flan? It's all mixed up, that's what. We'll have these sorts of things tickling your fancy over the next 60 minutes. Culture's producer has been getting square eyes watching and dissecting some great advertising. A printer orchestra, anyone?
I could go doo-doo-doo-doo and the printer here would go bop-bop-bop-bop. I mean, it was killer.
We lap up some of the sounds of Sierra Leone's subtle, soft powerhouse. It's Capital Radio, but not as you know it.
You've handled all these human rights things and corruption and been to this meeting. You just need a space where it's like the safe space where you just sit and get your thoughts together.
And WOMAD, that festival that stands for all that's right on, makes a power grab, probably a cuddly one, on Russia.
We need to start changing the image of the region and start working with people who would be the main customers of our tourist companies.
Plus, Sweden's wonderful electronicists El Paro del Mar come in for a session and a chat. We frankly fail to unravel the mystery of the North Sea Scrolls with the help and hinderment of Andrew Muller and Cathal Coughlin, and we'll check out the very refined sounding but rather cutting edge Margaret Mead Film Festival in New York City. It's a funny old thing. Close your eyes, turn up the radio and enjoy it. It's called Culture. It's here on Monocle 24. I'm Robert Bound. I hope you enjoy it. Right, we're going to start with a song. Gothenburg's Sarah Aspring, a.k.a. El Perro del Mar, came in to dish up a live session. And from it, this is Hold Off the Dawn.
Stay away, 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 away to hold off the dawn. Stay away, 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 away to hold off the dawn. Stay away, 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 away when all hope is gone. Stay away, 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 away to hold back the dawn. No need to talk about the future, baby. We don't need to talk about that. All I need to know is about you and me, babe. Can we make a new past if we run away, 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 run away from the day, the day, the day, the day, from the day.
Is there a way, a way, a way, a way to hold back the dawn?
And that was Hold Off the Dawn by El Paro del Mar. More from them later in the show. Time for a bit of advertising. There's an online spot which has recently caught our eye. As part of a wider campaign promoting Brother's latest printer, London agency Grey decided to turn a load of old office equipment into an orchestra. Their score? Bob Dylan's The Times They Are A-Changin', of course. Set in a plain white studio, the intricately positioned orchestra of sorts perform their masterpiece, while the camera pans across the scene, gradually revealing all 97 plastic and metal members of the ensemble, playing simultaneously to time. We're not the only ones who've noticed it. It's causing a lot of chatter online, and a filmmaker called James Houston has claimed the idea was actually his, something the agency deny. The issue of who owns what is a theme we'll be picking up on next year in a Culture Show advertising special. Well, not one to miss a good sound gadget, culture producer Katie Bilboa went to meet one of Grey London's creative directors, Nick Rowland, to hear more about how you make a hard drive harmonise.
It's an extraordinary orchestra of old office technology. So imagine printers and dot matrix printers and scanners and all the sort of technology of yesteryear all coming together to pay homage to this next generation Brother printer. The kernel of the idea started around the sort of the choice of music and how can we use a music track to really usher in, you know, the next generation. That's really where it started from. And then when you sort of go into that area, you can go, well, great, we can have bits of kit can actually sort of play musical notes and stuff. And wouldn't it be amazing if they all came together, played this sort of Bob Dylan track, and we sort of go to the scale and grandeur of an orchestra. You know, I think there's 97 machines in the end, and they each sort of set of instruments, if you like, they're divided up into their own section like an orchestra would do. So it suddenly becomes this grand gesture to this new machine.
In the time spent from someone having the original idea to you being in the studio with the orchestra itself recording, how many kind of stages of development are there that lead up to that point?
Well, this one was fairly quick. So I think we spent about a month from sort of original concept and then getting on set. So as I say, it was part of a broader campaign. So there's print ads and there's posters and there's digital stuff and so on. But really this sort of the filmic element was sort of a crash month. I mean, normally a sort of production process can be 6, 8, 10 weeks. So this was really sort of, is this good? Yes, this is good. Let's do it. Okay, right. And let's do it really quickly to sort of produce the material very quickly.
We're trying to make this orchestra out of all of these different types of electronic gizmos, stuff from the office, you know, printers, scanners, photocopiers, and just really helping them find the noises that they were looking for.
I knew we had to get these machines and modify them to become MIDI instruments for real.
We worked with Chris Cairns from Partisan, and he worked with a group of people called Is This Good, who are these just phenomenal guys who make all the technical stuff happen. So they take a very sort of what we think is a simple concept and they make it into an amazing piece of material.
What do they have to do to the printers to make them create the sounds and the sequences that we end up seeing on screen?
Basically, it involved taking them apart, reprogramming them, using MIDI to sort of turn them into musical instruments, and then an awful lot of trial and error. I mean, the guys are phenomenal. I mean, we did a lot of footage for the making of and filmed them doing their thing, and they were there for hours. I mean, just taking bits apart, soldering irons and rewiring and programming and trial and error and go this way and go that, and sort of God knows how many of these machines they killed trying to convert them. But it was an extraordinary effort. I mean, you know, as I say, to do it all in sort of from start to finish in 4 weeks was really, really cool.
I could go doo-doo-doo-doo, and the printer here would go bop-bop-bop-bop. I mean, it was killer.
Was that all done in situ? Was there any post-production to make it seem as if everything was happening at the same time?
That was the amazing technical feat, I think. So it's not just each individual instrument being able to do their own thing. It was all perfectly coordinated and choreographed and conducted like you would any orchestra. They played it, and they played it for real. And, you know, I guess the things that called a halt to some of the filming was every so often one of them burst into flames or just completely went quiet. So you sort of ripped that one out. So we've sort of went from whether it was 104 down to 97, but effectively it was they played it, we filmed it, they played it, we filmed it, and you just worked through like that. And it was, you know, it was amazing to sort of go from this process of seeing bits and pieces and individual printers or scanners doing their thing, and then suddenly they come together as this sort of full ensemble. It was really, really good to see.
So what was the atmosphere like when you finally got it to work and everything was going right at the same time?
There was a lot of joy, I think, but a lot of relief as well. We've got in that position now where it's a tremendously exciting time to be in the business, because there is so much good stuff happening in so many different places and in so many different media channels. You know, gone are the days when you can predict what people will be doing in 3 months, because it's literally, there are so many talented people and brands operating in spaces that they're not used to, because they have to take this because that's how they're going to connect with the consumer.
And those were the sounds of the Brother Printer Orchestra and Nick Rowland from Grey London there talking to Katie Bilbao. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where now we're heading to Africa to visit a radio station which is run with military precision. When it's not raining, that is. Capital Radio in Sierra Leone is not what you expect to find at a radio station in one of the poorest countries in the world. The presenters sound American and British, but with the exception of managing director, everyone is a Sierra Leonean. It's all part of their marketing strategy to appeal to the growing business community there and report on both the local and global music and fashion industries. Martin Davies visited Capital Radio in Freetown to find out more.
From Freetown, entertainment capital of West Africa, we proudly present the Capital Radio Chart Show.
I was born in London. Moved back to Sierra Leone with my parents in 1981. If I remember quite clearly, Adam and the Ants had just bought Stand and Deliver, Bob Marley had just died, and Princess Diana and Prince Charles were about to get married, and we moved to Sierra Leone.
And this week's chart, we've got 4 new entries, 2 re-entering the chart, more on them later, 4 going up, 25 going down, wow, and there's 5 non-movers.
Capital Radio is not quite what you expect in a country close to the bottom of the UN's Global Development Indicators rankings.
You might remember this from a few months back, and it hung around the charts for ages. Skrillex featured Syrah, here's Bangarang.
British troops served here during the country's civil war. Colin Mason was a broadcast expert as well as a soldier and saw a gap in the market. He now runs the station with military precision as its managing director.
Welcome to Capital Radio. We're delighted to come to visit the headquarters. There's my office, and if you're looking through this window here, you've got the our meeting room, our sales room, our boardroom, in fact.
And this compound's used during the conflict, wasn't it? It was the headquarters for the military.
It's seen an awful lot of action, this place, and quite a few rounds were flying over this this very location, but much more settled times now. What music? What format we were going to be, what was going to be our target audience. I knew from my time serving here as a soldier, there were a lot of stations who were playing Sierra Leonean music. But looking through the demographics, the one area that clearly wasn't being served was the business community, governmental community, the expats, the British military, all these kind of groups that were here. And we thought that should be our core audience.
One of the biggest hits this year across the world has been Call Me Maybe by Carly Rae Jepsen. It's actually caught on really, really well here, and it drives the listeners crazy here at Capital Radio, and you always get text messages asking for that song. And initially, I didn't think a song like that would actually catch on over here. Sierra Leone's always the sort of place where you never know what's going to catch on musically, and it just does.
My real name is Christopher Miami, but my DJ name is Chris Marlowe, and I am the head of sales here at Capture Radio Sierra Leone.
As his accent suggests, Chris was in California before returning home to West Africa. As the station targets the business community, it covers stories about local economy as well as carrying global business bulletins from the BBC. When average annual incomes are less than $800, you have to be innovative to make money. Chris is proud of a recent campaign he created to encourage sales during the difficult rainy season.
During the rainy season, the economy is down in Sierra Leone, and a lot of people are wary to advertise. So we came up with a package in which we reduced our rates for this season to show the business community that, look, even at Capture Radio, we go through the same thing, we're business. And so businesses that you would not normally hear on the radio came aboard. And it was a great success.
Meanwhile, over in McKennie, what we can expect for tonight is the same as Freetown. It's going to be overcast with a chance of a thunderstorm and some fog thrown in and temperature dropping to 22 degrees Celsius and wind.
The rainy season is a horrible, horrible, and I'll say it for the third time, horrible business atmosphere over here, because all our MDs, our CEOs, the president of companies, they're gone. Rainy season in Sierra Leone is summertime in the United States and summertime in the UK. And so there's nobody to actually, the real decision makers are not in the country. So, and it's wet.
Wet is an understatement. The tropical downpours can bring Freetown's potholed highways to a standstill. It's a reminder for this western sounding station that they're in the heart of Africa. And Colin Mason acknowledges there are other challenges too.
If you were anywhere in the West, say the United States or the UK or anywhere in Europe, generally speaking, the infrastructure allows you to operate your radio station bang on time. But here there are problems. Early in the morning, it may not be possible to get transport into the radio station. And similarly, I think, as in most of Africa, not everybody is getting 100% medical care all the time. So illness can be a factor.
Capital Radio, the driver's friend.
But if a station sounds like it could be in London or LA, what impact does it have on the local audience? Is it really offering what is wanted? As the head of a local human rights organisation, Valnora Edwin fits the station's listener profile. She's used to giving independent analysis. So does Capital Radio fulfil her needs after a hard day at the office?
6:29, we're just about a minute away from the half-hour news, and also Russell's got the World Business Report in about 10 minutes' time.
You've handled all these human rights things and corruption and been to this meeting. You just need a space where it's like the safe space where you just sit and get your thoughts together and you're ready to charge on to something else, to tune to the next radio station to hear what they're saying. But then I think I just like the way they're operating, and I don't think they should change.
She's not alone in approving of the mix of music, fashion, business and news. The independent radio sector only emerged here 2 decades ago, half of that time while the Civil War was going on. But with its targeted approach and military precision, it would seem Capital Radio is set to remain on the listener's dial. For Monocle in Freetown, I'm Martin Davis.
You're tuned into Culture on Monocle 24. After this break, I'll be chatting to the North Sea Scrolls.
Revolutions are fertile conditions for filmmakers, so Monocle took a front row seat at the Doha Tribeca Film Festival to witness the cinema of change emerging in the Arab region.
Like anywhere, when there's social change, people want to raise their voices and want to share what they've been through or what they've experienced. And what I like, it's they do it in a very intimate way. And that's what we want to acknowledge as well, because I think it's stronger and smarter on the long run.
Spotlight on celluloid dreams in the Arab world, premiering on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Now what? You might well ask. The North Sea Scrolls is a concept album by an extraordinary trio of talents. Luke Haynes, famously of The Auteurs and the none more caustic autobiography, Cathal Coughlan of Micro Disney, and Andrew Muller, music writer, tricky travel aficionado, and Monocle 24 host with the most. The album is fantastically imaginative and slightly tortuous journey through the alternative history of the British Isles. I spoke to Andrew and Cathal to try and work out what the hell it was all about, while marvelling that the most catchy song on the record is called I'm Not the Man You Think I Am, Karen, I'm the Actor, Tony Allen.
By the time Tony Allom had put the final brushstrokes to the last of the Screaming Popes, it became apparent that the actor had transgressed the fourth wall. He spent the long days of his wilderness years replaying a vinyl 45, I'm On My Way by Dean Parrish, over and over again.
My favourite song on the album is called I'm Not the Man You Think I Am, Karen. I'm the actor Tony Allom. Maybe you could shed some light on Tony Allom's sort of Christ-like presence over this record.
Well, he did spend some time at sea, possibly on one of those pile-driven kind of metal islands off the Kent coastline. It is said that he did broadcast for a time. He was quite a Northern Soul fanatic. He participated in counterfeiting the works of Dean Parrish, the brilliant I'm On My Way. And later on, yes, he turned up in Kavanagh QC and some other environs of that kind.
And personally, your fascination with Tony Allom, it's not just because he was something of a sort of a showbiz renaissance man.
He was Sid James' secret lover, a patient of R.D. Lang, and the actual hand, I think we're right in saying, behind the works of Francis Bacon. a remarkable figure.
Quite remarkable. Both Francis Bacon's or just the latter?
Just the latter, I think. Obviously, if he was the former as well, that would be ridiculous.
But that would never fit into your timeline at all.
Indeed.
It would be too crazy to fit into the timeline. There are some probably unsavoury names that you've rescued on this record. The more savoury name, I always think of him maybe as a peace-loving man, Tim Hardin, sort of not quite forgotten wonderful folk singer. He's reinvested by you guys as Tim Hardin MP.
Till Division Bell. Good evening, Mr. Hardin, sir. You speak well on TV. And you sing, I heard, he says, I aim to serve, a sweating heart he flees. Colony rule.
I've always been a fan of Tim. Well, the first four albums are just absolutely peerless, but little is known about what happened after that. I mean, some people say he became a terrible drug addict, and, you know, we all know he met quite a tragic and early demise. But what wasn't known until now was that he actually came to Britain. He became an MP for a Cornish constituency, became very friendly with a man called Bing Spear, who was the governmental drug administrator. And he was generally built up by the administration to provide amusement for the Cornish people, and he got a bit carried away, as can be the case in a sort of Coriolanus way, and became a spear carrier for their independence movement, and had to be expelled from Britain by Jimmy Goldsmith.
There are a lot of historical niceties and sort of writerly conceits in the construction of this record. I want to talk about the music as well. Cathal, you're on vocals/instruments in the in the credits of the record. Andrew, you're on narrations.
Yes.
You're taking this thing live. Tell us how that's going to work. What are people going to see when they come and see you?
They're going to see a lot of pith helmets.
Yeah, so I've got to talk people through the sleeve here. Andrew, you can talk us through the sleeve.
Yes, we are in fact pictured on the sleeve wearing broadly the stage costumes, which are, for the benefit of our viewers,
those being in black and white.
Exactly, pith helmets and kind of, old school jungle fatigues decorated with lots of entirely unearned Eastern European medals. I'm not sure where the pith helmets idea came from. Like so much of this project, it just sort of occurred to us. And we went out and bought them before we'd actually given any thought to. Do you know what an immense pain in the neck they are to transport?
Do you have to put them in a hat box?
Well, three pith helmets does, I'm here to tell you, as the person who got saddled. I'm the kind of pith helmet roadie of the Scrolls.
But the glamour.
It takes up a lot of luggage space, three pith helmets.
Yeah, they're big things. I mean, do you need to transport them and care for them? I mean, is it like buying a hat from Locke and Sons? You have to take very good care of it, put it in its box, keep it upside down? Is that how it works?
We possibly should, but we
but
don't.
Sod it. You should just wear them on the 777 that you will doubtlessly be flying around on.
Yeah, well,
like Rihanna.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's got to be the way. But I mean, our Indonesian tour later on in the year might be a bit, you know, difficult.
We'll be dressed for the tropics, though.
We will already be dressed for the tropics, indeed. But
And I'd like to say on here, to sort of delineate the responsibilities in the band, possibly Andrew is proudly holding a cricket bat. Luke has got a sitar, I think.
Yes.
And you're on the xylophone there, Coughlin.
It's a glockenspiel.
That's you told.
I thought this was going to be easy. And the record's very dense lyrically. When people take the CD out of its sleeve, pop it in, you'll find a very rich aural soup with which to contend and enjoy. Andrew, you're on narrations.
Yes.
But how did the writing of the lyrics work? Was that something shared between the three of you or just you?
No, Luke and Cahill wrote their own songs individually. And a lot of the songs were based on discussions we had about what this project might involve, which started out extremely vague and then gradually grew less so, I think it's fair to say.
It is, yeah.
So a lot of the ideas for songs were generated from those discussions, but Luke and Cahill wrote them individually. And then once we had the complete collection together, I then sat down myself and wrote the narrations, which link them all together in some sort of sense. So it was kind of, everybody did their own thing, but it does with, I think, the same point on the horizon in view.
And did those feet, someone once asked, in ancient time walk upon England's mountain green? The short answer is no. The longer answer is contained in the North Sea Scrolls, crucial excerpts of which will be revealed shortly.
And that was Andrew Miller and Cathal Coughlin, who are the North Sea Scrolls, talking to me last week. And that album is out now. Still to come in part two, more from Gothenburg's El Perro del Mar in our Midori House session. We go mad for WOMAD in Russia and go to a tweedy-sounding but genuinely rocking film festival in New York City. Margaret Mead, anyone? First up, it's time to hear more of our Midori House session from this week. From their album Pale Fire, this is El Perro del Mar with Walk On By.
Solitude's my best friend. The only one who sees me cry. Tells me I will never need another man if I keep my head up and walk on by. Solitude, my best friend. I trust you, you will never let me down. You tell me I'll be better off not wondering why. Thank you.
body without a heart. I'm missing every part. Like a soul without a mind, in a body without a heart. I'm missing every part.
That was El Paro del Mar with Walk On By and Why Ruin a Fab Formula. After the session, I had a chat with Sarah Aspring.
This is actually quite a turn that I've done with this album, using that much electronic stuff and using samples a lot. I guess it goes in along the way where I'm always kind of pushing the barriers for myself with what I do. And at this time, I just really felt I wanted to make a clubby album. I think what it came out of was that my state of mind writing the album came from a really dark place. And the last thing I wanted to do was to make a dark album. So that's where the dance inspiration and the will to dance and the will to, you know, to move on or to move to something better comes in.
To turn it up a notch.
Yes.
Because your previous records have been more low-key and they've been sparer, more echoey production on them, maybe.
Yeah.
So this does feel kind of like we're going back to the future.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, a little bit
and
like that.
And it sounds
that.
Great. Yeah. It's a cool thing. Was it nice to be able to incorporate those beats and kind of pep yourself up lyrically and change yourself up? I mean, is that a nice challenge to respond to be working with a little bit of a different production?
Definitely, definitely so.
And maybe you can talk us through the studio stuff. Do you kind of get up at 3 a.m. and write things down on a piece of notepaper, or do you have quite a working day?
It all falls into different stages and different periods, I guess, the whole process. When I'm actually in the studio recording, I'm very disciplined and I work like 12 hours and on a row, no breaks, nothing, and until I go mental, I guess.
And those are the best bits.
Yeah, it is. I mean, yeah, it's a very strange relationship you have to your work, I guess, because it's a very much a love relationship. I'm always, I think, at the verge of losing my mind, I think, when I'm working on an album.
And in terms of performing these new songs live, we should tell people what this looks like, what the Midori House session that they've just listened to looks like, because it is you and Jacob on, you know, it's two people and lots of boxes,
yes.
Lots of boxes of tricks.
That's what
and
it sounds
it's got such a bigger sound. I mean, you both play. I don't know. I'm going to have to admit my ignorance. What's the name of the? It's like a keyboard. It's like a keyboard that you blow through.
It's the melodica.
Melodica, yeah. Of course, it is.
The classic.
Things like that are kind of nice. It's nice to presumably play around with that and give it a bit of do some playing,
yes.
rather than that.
Yeah.
And is it a different? Do you find yourself performing in a different way because these songs are a little bit more upbeat? I've got a little different production on them.
I do, definitely, yeah. I'm used to, I've been playing in so many different constellations during my career and my different albums. It's all been very different with every album. And this album, it's, you know, this kind of electronic-based, sparse, you know, but heavy still setup. And it requires more I think focus and, you know, output from me, but I really like that. I really like to focus on my vocals a lot. And
I was going to ask you, as a vocalist, it must be nice when your beats are laid down and mm-hmm. and they're kind of decided, you know, your set is kind of decided in advance and you've programmed your machines to do what they do, then you can focus on the vocals.
Exactly.
I guess because it sounded like those songs could be very difficult to sing, harmonizing up and down or singing above and below the beats. It's a tough
it is quite
act
tricky
to pull, right?
Yeah, sometimes very tricky. That's the trickiest part. You know, I'm used to carrying around my guitar and playing a lot of guitar at other times, and now not doing that, and now it's more of a, you know, focusing to the beats. And you know,
and I wanted to ask you finally, like, Gothenburg's got quite a famous music scene, and a lot of people sort of can come out there, whether it's the labels or whether there's something in the water. Is that something that you feel part of, or is that once you're an artist of a certain stature, it doesn't kind of matter where you're from?
I've never really thought of the significance of coming from Gothenburg or from any other city. But there is a scene. There's been a really, you know, influential scene in Gothenburg, and I don't think it's a coincidence. I mean, it is a certain kind of city. It is a, I think it, for me, it's the right kind of bleak city, you know, the right kind of, like
Sweden's
Manchester.
Yeah, right,
it is.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it brings out, you know, it brings out certain things out of people in, you know, just for the sake of staying alive, I guess, to be creative. Like, in that sense, I feel a companionship to other artists coming from Gothenburg. But the funny thing about the characteristics or the characteristics of a Gothenburg artist is that you're usually quite isolated. You don't really socialize that much with each other, which is a real, I mean, Stockholm is a real difference there because there's a really social.
It's a very
scene,
yeah, so much.
There.
It's an outdoor. It's,
yeah,
it's an outdoor city even in the,
yeah,
winter.
Yeah, it is.
It?
Yeah. And Gothenburg, I don't feel is in that. It doesn't really work that way. You sit, people sit in their own studios or in their own workplace, you know, working on their stuff and being very secretive until it comes out. And you know, that's it's a very somehow strange attitude. And for many years, I liked that, and then it just kind of just killed me, I felt, you know, because you're
you get fed
so
up with dancing
lonesome
around your studio.
Exactly.
You want to do it in a venue.
Exactly, yeah.
Right. That was Sarah Aspring, a.k.a. El Perro del Mar, who are touring throughout Europe right now. And this is Culture with me, Robert Bound. We'll be heading to New York next, but first to Russia to talk music. The world of music, art and dance, to be precise, or WOMAD, as it's more commonly known. The festival was first held in Somerset in 1982, famously co-founded by Peter Gabriel. Over the past 30 years, it's spread to every corner of the world. Well, almost every corner. WOMAD's never been to Russia. But as Peter Van Dyke reports, that will change next year.
Russian troops bombard the capital of the Russian Republic of Chechnya in 1995. Although the Second Chechen War ended more than a decade ago, this is all most foreigners know about Russia's North Caucasus. Even today, almost all the news that reaches the West is of violence involving Islamist extremists. It's an image that Moscow, understandably, wants to change, not least because tourism is a big part of Moscow's plans to develop the mountainous region. This video promotes an off-road tour that takes in some stunning scenery. But despite the region being a vacation destination for Russians since Tsarist times, internationally it's a tough sell. The 2014 Winter Olympics in nearby Sochi ought to be a boost to the region, but officials want to get things moving before then. So, next September, it will host the first WOMAD festival in Russia.
This is exciting, isn't it?
Chris Smith is the WOMAD Festival's director. Announcing this festival at a press conference in Moscow, he said the spa town of Kislovodsk is just the sort of place that works for WOMAD.
Because we find that the festival works better if we're not right on the beaten track, because we're a destination festival. We're not. If we were to put this festival in Moscow, we'd be competing with everything else that happens in Moscow. In other locations, obviously, we are very much somewhere the focus and the destination.
The exotic location is something organisers are counting on to make the festival a success. Andrei Kataev heads the state tour firm North Caucasus Mountain Club.
Kislovodsk is a very popular place for tourism for Russia because it's mineral water, health and very, very good climate. And I'm sure that people will come and they will be happy because it's unique.
Chris Smith says WOMAD's experience in global festivals is unique too.
Over the last 30 years, WOMAD has presented over 200 festivals in 28 countries. The question is, how do we succeed? And the answer is very simple. The politician is not at the centre of the festival. Making money is not at the centre of the festival. It's the artist who sits at the centre of a WOMAD festival. And we believe that through that, we pull communities together.
Whatever Smith says, politics surely had a role in bringing WOMADs to the North Caucasus. The Russian government is spending billions of rubles to boost the region's economy, and tourism is a major part of plans to lift people out of poverty and turn them away from Islamist separatists that have been fighting Moscow for two decades. Anatoly Pak is the head of the state's North Caucasus Development Corporation.
We need to start changing the image of the region and start working with people who would be the main customers of our resorts and our tourist companies.
This aim means that success of the festival, for the first year at least, may not be measured in attendances or artists. Rather, says arts writer Vladimir Kozlov, the most important result could be the publicity.
It's not necessarily for local crowds, but it's for international media. Because if international media hear that some major world music stars come to perform at that festival in Kislovodsk, that's going to be quite a big media thing, and that's probably what the organizers want to achieve.
Kozlov says this will be helped by Russia's burgeoning festival scene.
It's really developing, it's really growing, and quite a lot of artists like to perform there, including foreign artists. I think it's fun for them to visit new places, and I think fees they are paid are quite good too.
Getting big names to the North Caucasus may well cost the organisers. Angie Mahachkala, the region's top soccer team, made Cameroon's Samuel Eto'o the world's best-paid footballer to get him to Dagestan. Kislovodsk is a couple of hundred miles to the west and largely unaffected by the violence elsewhere in the region. But Kozlov points to Angie as an example of why visitors need not worry about security.
Of course, footballers don't live in Mahachkala, but they come there for home games. And there hasn't been any security situation. So I think it will be possible to make sure that everything is okay at an international event of this kind.
Smith says he takes the assurances of WOMAD's local partners at face value, and Anatoly Pak is confident the security arrangements will be sufficient.
We work very closely with the authorities in the region and federally to make sure that all the security questions are addressed in advance and that we have all the mechanisms that are in principle possible in place for the festival to run smoothly.
So who might come? Russia's music scene is hardly cutting edge, and the biggest export of the past year was probably a group of little old ladies warbling a souped-up folk song at Eurovision. The Buranovsky Babushki finished second with Party for Everyone. A sign of how strongly Russian acts feature on WOMAD's radar at the moment, Chris Smith hadn't even heard of the Buranovsky Babushki, but he stresses there will be a lot of local talent on stage. Party for everybody. Maybe some of them can follow in the footsteps of St. Petersburg's Terem Quartet. They played WOMAD in the UK in 1991 and were quickly signed to the Real World record label. Perhaps next year, Russia's musical exports will be more than the Buranovsky Babushki, and the North Caucasus will be a good news story for once. For Monocle in Moscow, I'm Peter van Dijk.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. After this break, we'll hear about what's been billed as America's most important anthropological film festival.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time or download the show on Monocle24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24, where to finish today's show, we're crossing over to New York. Now in its 36th year, the Margaret Mead International Film Festival has become one of America's premier venues for exhibiting new international non-fiction cultural documentaries. Hosted by the American Museum of Natural History, this year's festival turned the spotlight on 29 new films, with globe-spanning content from Brazil to Pakistan. We sent Monocle's Barrett Austin to Manhattan's Upper West Side to see what was going down.
My name is Ruth Cohen. I'm the director of the Center for Lifelong Learning here at the American Museum of Natural History. And what the Center for Lifelong Learning does is open up the programs of the museum to the public. So the Margaret Mead Film Festival is one of our adult programs, and obviously it draws from the museum's tradition in anthropology, which is one of the chief areas that the museum now supports research in. We have six lead curators in anthropology and many, many researchers doing work around the world. The festival began in honor of Mead's 75th birthday and her 50th year working at the Museum of Natural History. What Mead did, both in her writing and in her documentation of the cultures that she studied, was really create a very human experience where it was no longer that you were looking at a foreign or distant culture that was divorced from your own reality. What she fostered was the understanding that people can connect and understand each other better when culture is alive, when you can see the human interactions that really define every culture and find the similarities there. And that happens really viscerally in film and in photography. And of course now, given what we're able to do technologically in film, we can see so many stories that we could never have seen before. And certainly in film, which has evolved beyond the still photography that was the mainstay at one point, and now into more interactive experiences. One of our showings this year is 18 Days in Egypt, which is a crowdsourced video about the Egyptian rebellion in Tahrir Square. And that is going to be a really interesting experiment to see how people relate to watching that as almost an experience of visual anthropology.
There's quite a significant focus on indigenous cultures at the festival. What are some of the films that are being shown this year exploring indigenous cultures?
We have a special focus on the Navajo this year. We are showing, in a kind of conversation, an older film called Through Navajo Eyes that was made by Navajo about Navajo. And in discussion with present-day Navajo makers and scholars who are going to comment on how that kind of documentation and storytelling has changed in the Navajo community. So that's really exciting. One of our films, Christmas in Manapanir, is about the Aboriginal culture in Australia and how they have adapted and made Christmas their own. It's a beautiful, beautiful film, and certainly a journey into a culture, and at the right time of year, that you just would never experience anywhere else.
To sort of follow off of that, there is this sense of experimentation in some of the films, I would imagine. But at first glance, the idea of attending a film festival that is focused on anthropology, nonfiction, documentary filmmaking, it may seem a bit academic to some, but would you say that there is a real focus on the aesthetics, the production, experimenting with new techniques in filmmaking as well?
Well, we go through quite a process to select the films that we do screen at the Mead, and we receive probably 900 or so submissions. And part of our criteria is that there is a story that comes through in the film, and the stronger the aesthetic, the more that story is going to come across. It is very much a part of what the selection committee decides when we pick a film for the festival. It's a important aspect of how people will relate to the story, will relate to the subjects in the film, how the film was actually made.
I want to ask a question that I would imagine no festival director wants to be asked. If there was one film that's a must-see from this year's festival, which one is it?
I can't answer that. All right, I'm looking forward to Jai Beam Comrade. It's 3 hours, Sunday afternoon. It's kind of the perfect immersion in an extraordinary filmmaker, Anand Patwardhan, very, very well known in India. His subject matter is hard, it's political, his filmmaking is beautiful. So that's one of the premieres that I'm most excited about. But I imagine others have many favorites.
So that's just about all we have time for this week on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Next week, it's an art theft special. No, we won't be telling you how to nab yourself a Picasso, but we will be exploring everything around the theme of art that's gone missing, got lost, or been stolen by thieves in the night. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer is Katie Bilburn. Holly Fisher didn't half work hard again. Time for one final song this week from the Midori House session. This is El Perro del Mar with Love in Vain. Thanks for tuning in.
First of all, but I'm not wasting time, oh, not on love. See, I never thought it would get me so. Sometimes